Hello, and whether you're out for a run or you're just listening to us casually, thank you for listening to the Tread Lightly podcast. We are excited to be here with you again today, and we have a fun topic for you today on things that set apart our BQ athletes. But first, we're going to answer a listener question. I'm co-host and running coach Laura of Laura Norris Running.
Hello, I am running coach and co-host Amanda Brooks of Run to the Finish. And if you don't know what BQ is, it's Boston Qualify. I kind of forget sometimes. There are these terms out there that not everyone knows, and then people on Instagram remind me. I don't know what that means.
It is amazing how adjusted we get to the jargon of it. It's kind of like anything, though. Like, my husband cycles, and he'll have this cycling jargon, and I'm just like, could you use layman terms for me, please?
Yes. So even in that, I think our runner question today is going to feel a little specific and also like something that a lot of you are going to ask about. So this is from Nick Jasek on Instagram. Hi, I recently discovered the podcast and love it. I hope this question hasn't already been addressed. Have you heard of or researched and used the supplement AltRed? If so, is it legit? So I know that Nick has been taking it and seen some benefits, but I am actually intrigued for us to chat about this because we do get a lot of supplement questions.
We do. I feel like we're probably due for a second part supplement episode. We had one really early on in season one. So an AltRed supplement is a beet juice supplement or beetroot powder supplement, nitric oxide, essentially. And nitric oxide, in short, is a vasodilator, which means it expands your blood vessels, capillaries, etc., which lets more blood get through to your working muscles. And so there is an ergogenic effect seen of improved performance, higher work capacity, better time to exhaustion, especially at like harder intensities, like I'd say 20 to 45 minute race duration for most athletes is where most of the research has seen a lot of benefit. It's a pretty safe supplement. A vasodilator is not recommended for people with low blood pressure because it can make your blood pressure go down. But other than that, all you have to really worry about is GI distress, and all these products are formulated to reduce that risk. The thing that really interests me is that they talked about it being expensive, which makes me wonder if they're using it all the time. Usually, these are something you just need to use in races and maybe a couple key workouts before races to make sure it works for you. What would you say?
So it's interesting. I chatted with registered dietitian Serena Marie about kind of beets and all the things that were out there about it. And there is definitely data showing that the beets can help with performance. But there's a couple things that were kind of important. So like you said, there are a bunch of other different powders out there or juices. And with a lot of them, the only way to see benefits was actually to take it consistently. And I feel like they're a little different than this particular product. This particular product, like you said, seems to be focused on kind of that energy. Whereas the others, it's more of a long-term effect where you're seeing things. One of the things I do know it can help around is like hot weather running. Like you said, that's kind of that vasodilator thing that's happening. So it could help there in terms of making things feel a little bit better. There is some studies that it could help with endurance. But yeah, each of these products is a little bit different. And so, you know, whatever, you could always test these things on yourself. There's not a huge downside to it other than the money that we put out.
Yeah. And I know with beet juice, it's like a, not dose makes the poison, it's a dose makes the performance impact. So like some of these lower dose ones, like you said, are meant to be for daily use. The higher the dose, the more acute the benefits are going to be. That's when you use it for racing. And I have had athletes and myself years and years ago use beet supplements before a race and feel pretty good from that. But again, what's placebo effect? What's actually going on? Because it's not like we're hooking ourselves up to lab equipment while doing this.
Yeah, I always think about placebo effect with a lot of this stuff. I read I can't remember which book it was recently. I need to find it though, but it was fascinating the amount of drugs that are out there, even really great ones that are like good for your heart, like people who have heart issues. And in trials, the placebo worked better than the actual medication. This applied to like kidney medicines, liver, like heart, all these things. And this is constantly happening across every drug trial that's out there. So I think honestly, our mental belief in what a lot of stuff does has a much, much bigger impact than what's in it.
Oh, yeah. And like sometimes with these supplement studies, they can do a placebo, like probably for something like this, just give someone red colored water, I guess, although the taste can sometimes give away. But sometimes it's difficult to actually control for the placebo effect in studies. So like that's sometimes a caveat if you read the full article of them being like, maybe a little bit of this was a placebo effect, because sometimes when you have a beet supplement, also you can tell you're taking the real thing from the taste of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay, let's move on to today's topic and talking a little bit about Boston qualifying. One of the things I did want to say before we start is that Boston qualifying is not just about who's working the hardest. I certainly had a long debate with someone on social media the other day that was kind of saying like, no, it's only people who are willing to work really hard that get better, do better, and people who are running slower just aren't willing to work hard. And I was like, well, there's just some natural talent out there. I mean, it does not mean that people are not working hard, but also we know folks who go out on their first time around, qualify for Boston and say, that didn't seem that hard, and other folks who have been trying for 10 years and are working really hard. So you can't deny that there's some natural genetics and talent that also go into things.
Oh, yeah. Genetics and talent are playing in. Privilege and life situation are playing in. Like if you have a nice job that gives you the leisure time to train and recover, it makes it different compared to if you're juggling a lot of things. So yeah, I feel like when people say, oh, it's just hard work, they're taking a oversimplified view of things.
Yes. So I know one of the things that happened that was pretty rough last year was the cutoff time was much, much larger than we expected at around 5 minutes. What do you think it might look like this year in terms of Boston qualifying times?
Yeah, so it's really hard to predict because it's not guaranteed to be more and more each year. I feel like this happened a few years ago where it was 5 or maybe even 7 minutes greater than the qualifying time. And then the next year it kind of normalized a bit. Because I do think when we have these years where there's a huge cutoff, the next year, not everyone puts in their name who's maybe in that squeaker zone of being like 1 to 2 minutes over, which then impacts the number of applicants and stuff. Races go through waves of popularity where sometimes, you know, tons and tons of people want to do Boston, other times still a lot, but not as many. So I wouldn't say like, oh, it's for certain going to be 5+ minutes next year. On the flip side, there's super shoes and all this stuff going on too. So, I mean, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a surge last year because finally we were back into full racing post-COVID, people who had been like training and were finally able to like put a lot of it to work. I think honestly, if I have an athlete whose goal is I want to run Boston, not just I want to hit a qualifying time, but I truly want to get in and I want to run that race, this year I would probably still be saying, can we aim for that 5 minutes faster? And 5 minutes is a sizable difference in your marathon goal. So you also have to just be very honest about if that additional 5 minutes is truly doable for where you're at right now. And I say that partially because I think having talked to a lot of the people who were in that group that didn't make it, I think they will try again this year and they already have the base fitness to get close. So now they're just leveling up versus if you're coming in and you're 3 minutes from your BQ and now we have another 5 minutes that we need to add in there.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. And yeah, I mean, it's just all something to plan. But yeah, 5 minutes is a large amount of time in the marathon. It's not just something you can wing on race day.
Yeah. So I think even in your training, if you've set Boston qualifying as your goal this year and you're thinking about that 5 minute buffer, don't just immediately drop your marathon goal time by 5 minutes. It really is a significant drain in the whole training plan. So I would start out with your goal and then be willing to kind of adjust as you're going through training and seeing how your fitness is progressing. Can you adjust that goal time down a little bit to work inside that buffer? But yeah, just know that like saying, okay, my goal was 340, now I'm going to make it 355 is a much bigger deal than it might sound like.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, if you do qualify from the times and you don't make the cutoff, just let that build your confidence that you at least qualified and work, make it a goal to work towards the cutoff there. But then, you know, beyond like goal setting and thinking about that, when we're looking at something like qualifying for Boston, first comes down to even before training is choosing a race. Some courses, quite simply put, are better for hitting a BQ than others. So how do you kind of guide athletes through race selection for a BQ?
Yeah, 100%. We even have data out there on like percentages of people at races that are Boston qualifying. Not surprising that some of the really big ones, Chicago and New York, actually have a high percentage of Boston qualifiers. They are a very large race, so that is part of it. But there are others, CIM, Philadelphia, St. George, Grandma's, any of the Revels that are downhill, Mesa, Indy. Those are some of the ones with the highest number of Boston qualifying times. And I think that comes down to a couple things. One, they're generally flat or downhill, net downhill, and they tend to have pretty good racing weather. So being in the 40s or somewhere around there. Chicago is flat, but it's a tough one because it is not unusual for it to be hot. And that can make it harder to really sustain a hard pace.
It can. The weather is a huge impact. I think also some of those races work well for athletes for a BQ because they've gained a reputation for working well for a BQ. So people go there and then you have a pack of people running your same pace. You can pace off of them when the miles get tough. It's not like some races where you end up running a large chunk of your marathon by yourself, which becomes really, really difficult to hold a pace when you get fatigued.
100%. I couldn't agree more. I think it is really helpful to just have other people around who are holding the same pace. So one of the other things to kind of look at when it comes to racing is most of the Boston qualifying folks are not over racing. They're not trying to squeeze 3 to 4 marathons into their year. They're picking an A goal. And then we're doing other races. We're doing shorter races, half marathons, 10Ks, so that we're practicing all of that race day stuff, like the nerves and the atmosphere, but we aren't cramming in a boatload of marathons.
I think that's a really important point because people are trying to race multiple marathons a season, or people race a marathon, miss a BQ, and try to do one again in like 2 months' time. Sometimes even for some athletes to race a BQ marathon, pick one per year and race shorter distances the other times of the year to work on speed and to not like mentally overtax yourself, because marathons are hard no matter how fast you run them.
100%. I do think it's valuable to do other races, like you said, shorter distance races. That was something I even sort of realized for myself in the last couple of years, was the things that you're just learning during the race. So that kind of like, what is that mental talk like when things are hard? And especially when you're pushing in a 10K where it's a much harder pace than even you're going to be going at your marathon, and finding that kind of, how do I keep myself motivated to stay in that pain cave? That's going to translate on marathon day when you're in those last couple miles and you've got to find a way to keep holding the pace.
Yeah. It really, really makes a difference. Also, I apologize quickly to all our listeners if you hear odd noises in the background. my kid is sick from school and she is playing with Barbies right now. And we all know how much drama can happen in the Barbie dream house. So that's going on. I apologize for that. Hopefully it edits out. The next thing that is really important before we even think about training is thinking about your fueling. And this is something I really, really encourage athletes to think about from the beginning of their marathon cycle, maybe even before, is are you able to support your training with adequate nutrition before, during, after runs, all day long, as well as your race day nutrition plan?
100%. I feel like a lot of the onboarding athlete calls I have when they tell me Boston qualifying is a goal, then I say nutrition has to be dialed in. Like you said, part one is what you're doing all day long. And then part two is that we have to get your race day and your long run nutrition right. Because that is the engine that's like keeping you going. And so often it kind of is a secondary thing that we think about because we think about the training first.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll have some athletes be like, well, I don't like gels. I just don't take them, but I still want to be Q. And it becomes a, like, no, we need to work on this from day one of training, work on it, maybe in an easy run first if it feels really difficult in a long run. But I've seen that so often be the hindrance to a BQ is an athlete who isn't eating enough in general, who doesn't take gels that work for them, or who on race day decides to skip their fueling plan because they just don't feel like taking that fifth gel or something.
Yeah, I think that last part is key. Once you have a plan, you have to find a way to force yourself to stick to it. You may not feel like, in fact, most of us don't feel like taking those gels or drinking that water, but you have a plan for a reason. And so sort of just telling yourself, I am doing this because this is part of what's going to get me to my goal. And like you said, fueling on your long runs isn't just the gels. It's also the hydration. So if you aren't hydrating enough, then you aren't able to often like absorb those gels or use them. And that's going to cause GI issues and all kinds of other things. So it really is spending your training cycle being willing to test and plan. And you've talked about this before in other episodes, but can you take in a little bit more than you were taking in before? And that's something I personally have been really working on too, especially as we see all this data that now says maybe we can take in more and that's going to result in better performance.
Oh yeah. Like of my athletes who BQ, or I know BQ can be like a little harder for men, but are, you know, pretty fast. They're all running in the 3 to 3.5 hour range. They're taking in a gel probably every 25 minutes in their races, or roughly every 5K. And I know sometimes when people hear that, they're like, how often do you want me to do that? And they're taking in calories from their sport drink too, but then they'll have such a strong race and it really, really pays off. And it's not like you're going to like get diabetes or gain weight from fueling in your long runs. Cause I hear that concern. I hear that concern. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. 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 Same sort of idea around fueling all day long, not cutting out carbs. If you're really, really nervous about nutrition or your weight, and so you aren't fueling enough, maybe this is a time to just work with a sports nutritionist for a little bit. A lot of times that will alleviate a lot of those concerns as you see your body is able to actually perform better. So 100%, you can always reach out to us on Instagram at @treadlightly, and we can recommend some folks if you're like, yep, I'd love to work with someone and get my plan nailed down.
So then the next piece of the puzzle, the one that I think everyone gets excited about, is training. How many miles should you do? What type of workouts should you do? How many 20 milers is always a big, big question here. So what are some commonalities you've seen in your athletes who have been able to BQ?
Yeah, I think it changes a little bit as the BQ gets faster and faster and faster. So depending on your age group and where you're at. But a lot of the time we are seeing higher volume running and we see data supporting that. And again, high volume is also relative, which we have talked about on other shows. So that does not mean 100 miles a week. It might simply mean you were at 40 and we work our way up to peaking around 60. There may be other athletes, like I said, I think when they're getting towards that 3 and even like 245, like when we're really getting down there, sometimes they are pushing 70, 80. Like they're pushing pretty high mileage weeks because they're really good at running their easy days easy enough.
Yes. Yeah. High volume makes a huge difference. Again, like you said, we're not saying go run 80 miles per week when most of those miles are at a 9 pace. But what I find for a lot of athletes even is thinking about the duration of each session. So outside of long runs, we're trying to get our easy runs to like 75-ish minutes, maybe one midweek workout that's like 90 to 100 minutes if your schedule permits, because of the metabolic benefits and the like fatigue resistance benefits that come from extending those sessions. So it's not just how many miles per week, because 40 miles per week is going to look a lot different for someone running 4 days versus someone running 6 days. It's how can we manipulate the individual sessions so that each one is higher volume.
I love that. I really agree with that. There is something really beneficial to getting to where your everyday easy run is 75, 90 minutes, whatever. And that just feels natural and normal, versus all your weekday stuff is 45 minutes and then you've got a really long run on the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a huge difference. Then the next thing that everyone loves to talk about, kind of building off high volume, are the long runs. And I will say, like, I know we see some plans online and I know that certain methodologies say, oh, all you need is 16 miles maximum as your long run. And I've never seen that work out in training athletes. Usually for my athletes who qualify for Boston, we're doing probably like 3 20 to 22 milers, usually like two 20s and a 22 miler, or two easy 20s and one 20 with a hard workout built in, which I guarantee you is harder than a 22 miler. Actually, it really, I think, makes a difference. And when we're talking about these athletes also, it's not like they're out there for 6 hours doing these 20 milers.
Yes. This one is always a touchy subject for me because I've gotten in trouble in the past. But I agree. Like, I rarely have seen 16 when the goal is Boston qualifying work. And again, every athlete is different. So there are absolutely going to be people that works for. That's totally fine. But one of the other things with these long 20 and 22 mile runs is the whole mental side of that. So that time on your feet, that time of like just being out there longer, and what's that going to feel like? And okay, I made it to 22. I only need to do 4 more. For me personally, if I only get to 16 and I have another 10.2 to do on race day, I'm freaking out, let alone thinking that I can hold my goal pace for that entire time. So I think, yes, maybe with certain plans and the right physiology, it can work. But you still got to have a big mental belief in yourself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think like 16 miles, at least for me, as someone with like where GI issues can affect a race, like it doesn't give a sense of like, how is my gut going to handle several gels? And sometimes even for like my athletes, instead of framing it as a 22 miler, I'll be like, listen, our goal time is 3 hours. So you're going on a 3 hour long run. Obviously, you're going to cover less distance, but that way you know exactly how it feels to take as many gels as you will on race day and all that other stuff with that confidence that you said. And when I've had athletes do that, they've been like, wow, that's a game changer.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, the practicing the gels. Can't say it enough. One of the other things you mentioned there was race pace miles. And there's been some conflicting information that has also come out on social media from some folks saying you should do all of your long runs at your goal pace. And I think we've already dispelled this, but folks, no, that also does not work for the majority of folks. Sometimes you can get away with that kind of shenanigans in your early 20s, but then it catches up with you at some point. So when it comes to long runs, I'm with you. I love kind of over the course of the training cycle, building goal pace miles into some weekday stuff and into that long run. And sometimes it might start out as, you know, you're just doing like 3 by 1 miles, although by the time you're at this point, you might be doing a little more than that, but 3 by 1 miles at goal pace. But then we're building up. You could have, like you said, a 15-mile day where we're doing 10 to 12 at goal pace. We've really built up strong to that. Yeah.
I mean, I think it makes a huge difference. But a lot of times when you are talking about qualifying for Boston, you probably do want at least 8 miles continuous at goal pace, up to 10 to 12, like you said, if you can handle it. Because again, we want to make sure that you're able to tolerate the fatigue, to tolerate that pace. And if 10 miles at marathon pace is too hard in training, it might be worth reassessing your goals.
Yes. And I think some of that too is just getting a sense of what it should feel like. So often I've seen so many plans where like we race or we train faster and we train slower, but nothing in the plan is actually at race pace. And there's huge benefits to both sides of that. But if we never do race pace and we show up on race day, we don't even know exactly how it should feel for us.
Along with that, though, we do want to run faster than marathon goal pace in training. So I've seen methodologies almost take the flip where they're like, we're only doing marathon pace for 8-10 weeks, no other workouts. And you kind of lose touch with those other aspects of fitness, lose touch with the ability to push hard. And so it's a fine balance, but like throughout marathon training, you want to run a variety of paces, especially earlier on, I would say. And then sometimes even close to the race, a threshold run can really help. Just remember that you can run faster than marathon pace and build your confidence at marathon pace.
I think the other benefit to doing some short, fast stuff is obviously there's all the physiological stuff. We're getting those fast twitch things moving, but it can give a different feeling to your marathon goal pace because after you've had to do like, you know, a workout of 800s at your mile pace or you've run a 5K, marathon pace feels a little bit more enjoyable because it's not quite as intense as those levels. And we do know that working on some of that short speed translates over into your marathon.
It does. It absolutely does. Like I think only training at marathon paces can make people slower over time. That's not to diss any methodologies that use that. We're just kind of giving what we've observed. Now, training is only as good as your ability to recover from it. You need to recover in order to adapt. And that's where I think athletes who actually do BQ can stand apart a lot from those who try and try again and can't ever make that training manifest into race day, because some people think, oh, if some is good, more is better, and I'm going to run 7 days a week, or I'm not going to take a rest day, or I'm going to cut into sleep to get these workouts done, when really you need to prioritize recovery when trying to train for a BQ.
Yeah, I think it's really easy when you've trained and missed a goal to think, I'm just going to train harder. And sometimes that's not what we need. We just need some tweaks and a little bit of a shift. I'm with you for most of our athletes. I like seeing a rest day. Again, some of them do thrive on two. I've had a number of folks also say that they do something where it's more like every 10 days they take a rest day. And that tends to be folks for me who are much higher mileage, have been doing this quite a while, and are really on some of those faster speeds for their marathon goal time, so sub 3. So that's kind of knowing your body and knowing what you can handle is getting results for you. But for most of us, you have to consider that training is not your entire life. You're not an elite. So you have work and family and all these other things. And if you're not giving your body a day to catch up to all the work and de-stress, it can just make training feel even harder.
It can. And then recovery is also like, it's both on that micro scale you talked about of weekly rest days. And then it's also on broader time horizons where we want to be thinking about, are you taking cutback weeks? And then after races, are you taking time off? And then having a maintenance recovery phase, not just taking a couple days off and jumping into your next marathon training cycle. I all my athletes who BQ have serious downtime for about like 4 to 6 weeks of low volume running after their goal races.
I feel like that's one of the things we refuse to learn from elite athletes. They take this major chunk of time off and all of us are like, nope, 3 days, I'm good to run. So that is something to kind of look at when you're really pushing your body that hard. And I think the other thing is sleep. And I know that it's easier said than done for a lot of folks to get enough sleep when you do have small children and things like that. But if there's anything you can do to help with your quality or the amount of sleep you're getting, there's just too much research to ignore on the fact that it works and it helps.
Yeah. Like, I know some people are like, oh, I only need 5 hours. You just have adjusted to the fatigue you have. You'd probably feel even better if you got enough sleep. Now, there are some few other things that I think we both have noticed in coaching that is a commonality in all our BQ athletes. And the one I've seen a lot is that they don't define themselves or their running by this goal. It's a goal they have. It's something they want to achieve, but they don't develop this obsession with it, or they don't feel like they're not a runner if it doesn't happen. They enjoy the process. When an athlete feels like they have to BQ, or they start to feel like it's work and it's another job to BQ, that to me is always a red flag that like it might not happen because they're too in their head about it.
I think that's a huge point, because the number of times even myself where I was like, I'm just going to run this race for fun. And then I had one of my best races ever. And I see that in athletes all the time. You kind of have taken the pressure off. And so they go out with, I'm just going to see how this feels and have fun. And because they're not so tense and so stressed, they have like a surprising, awesome day. And I think some of that also comes through in training when you're like, I really enjoy running. Like, I'm excited to see what I can do in this workout. I'm just excited to see what I can learn in this long run. So that shift in mindset and kind of finding those ways to stay in that is, I think, a really huge piece that's not talked about that much.
It really isn't talked about enough. And with that is the patience and understanding that just because you have a bad workout or maybe you miss a BQ once doesn't mean you can't do it. Things sometimes take multiple attempts, and we see that with elites. Think of like when Shalane Flanagan won New York City a few years back. It was something she tried for years, or when Desi won Boston. They didn't give up on their goal just because it took a little bit longer to get there than they planned. And the same applies for you.
Yep. Another piece of that would be kind of mindset when we're racing. And Matt Fitzgerald's book, How Bad Do You Want It, is a good one to read around that. Kind of talks about leaning into the pain cave, or like finding ways to kind of help yourself work through that. And so that's a good one to read on that. But also, like we talked about earlier, having some of those practice races where you work through what that's going to kind of feel like. And I'm a huge fan of visualizing. In fact, I was reading a little bit more recently. That is something that a lot of the elites do. They really do spend time visualizing. And that means not just visualizing like, I'm having the perfect race day, everything feels amazing, but visualizing that moment where it's feeling a little tough and how you pull yourself out of it, visualizing yourself taking in all your fuel, you know, all those little pieces. It's just that consistent reframing and reminder to your mind that like, I've got this, I can do this, like I've seen it, you know, now I'm just putting that plan into action.
Yeah. And I think that's really good to visualize the ups and downs of a race, because sometimes people have in their head that, oh, the race I BQ at is going to be this perfect unicorn, and yeah, pun kind of intended there, but this perfect unicorn day of I'm going to feel amazing the whole time and it's going to just come effortlessly. And that's often not the case. So you have to accept that it's going to be hard and that you might have to troubleshoot within the race itself. And having to do so doesn't mean that anything's wrong.
That's such a good point. It's troubleshooting within the race. I think that's actually just another quality of folks who end up hitting their time. It's finding that way to kind of pull yourself through things or see what's happening and deciding how you need to adjust.
That is so true. And, you know, I think you're wanting to have a marathon that feels really good, All of these tips can apply to you. They aren't exclusive for people trying to qualify for Boston.
100%. All right, runners. Again, we hope this was another episode that gave you some information that you can put to use. As always, if you have other questions, you can reach out to us on Instagram at @treadlightlyrunning. If you're looking for coaching, you can reach out to either of us as well. We're happy to see what room we have on the roster to help you out.
Yes. And as always, please rate, review, and subscribe. I've heard people are finding us in the algorithm, and it's because of everything you're doing for us with that few moments of time. So please do it if you haven't, and thank you if you did. And thank you for listening.